And welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. One summary of historian Ilan Stavin's new book begins this way. Enough with the dead white men. Forget what you learned in school. The true story of the United States lies not with the founding fathers or robber barons, but with the country's most overlooked and marginalized peoples.
Stavins refers to what he calls America's humblest folk, workers, immigrants, housewives, slaves, and others who seem to be absent from the dominant narrative of the nation. He's compiled their stories into a contrarian history of the United States. And in true contrarian form, Stavins' history book is told in the form of cartoons. Ilan Stavins is a professor of Latin American and Latino culture at Amherst College, and his new book is called A Most Imperfect Union, A Contrarian History of the United States. It's written by Stavins and illustrated by Lalo Alcaraz. And Ilan Stavins joins us now from the studios of New England Public Radio. Welcome back to the program, Professor Stavins.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. I wonder if you might be able to start out with one of the particular stories that your contrarian stories, if I might call them that, that you bring up in the book. And that it happens fairly early on, and it's about a man named Ayuba Suleiman Diallo. I was really interested about why you included him. Tell us a little bit about him.
This is the one of the first narratives that we have of immigrants to the United States, and it is an opportunity to reflect on the fact that the very first newcomers to this country were not only the settlers or the slaves, but sometimes other types of folks that came in chains or free. In this case, it was an Arab who wandered through the United States and left us with an astonishing account of what he saw and how he reacted. And the purpose of the entire book is to offer these alternative narratives, to see that the history that we receive is not always the history that really belongs to us, that we are the ones that have to shape that history and find in the past those that have had voices that in many ways connect to ours, and they represent what went beyond power, went beyond the establishment. He was one of them.
You know, in Diallo's case, you note in the book that he was captured by his fellow Africans and sold into slavery, then brought to the United States, first arriving in Annapolis, sold as property. But eventually, he is imprisoned at a county courthouse where lawyer Thomas Blewett defends him. And Blewett hears Diallo's story and writes a essentially his version of Diallo's slave narrative or his life narrative, right?
And in so doing, leaves us Diallo's account, but also filters it through the account of the one that is able to write, the one that is able to tell the story. And that is the aspect that attracts me
exactly.
most to Diallo's characters. Who is speaking and how are we receiving those voices? Who is the intermediary, the conduit that enables us to reach back to those voices?
Especially since Diallo himself was actually totally literate in Arabic. It wasn't
exactly.
as if he couldn't write.
And this is an opportunity, and I'm delighted that you started with Diallo, to stress the fact that this is a country that that has alternative narratives that have been written, had been lived in other languages. This is a country that is multifaceted and multilinguistic, a country made of immigrants that have experienced it in the texture, in the sensibility of the language that they came with. And that sensibility is the one that sometimes we should recover to be able to appreciate the very value that they brought with.
Right. Now, there are many issues to discuss about contrarianism, about patriotism, and its discontents, if I may put it that way, about creative destruction, as you point out, as a repeated theme in American history. But I just wanted to ask you more broadly, why tell this different history through the form of a comic or a graphic novel? I mean, you and Lalo Alcaraz have worked very successfully before in your other book, Latino USA. But what was it about U.S. history that you thought was ripe for a graphic treatment?
I think the answer to that question has to do with my role as a teacher. I am privileged to have terrific students And I witnessed the way they approached the world. It used to be, when I first started teaching 25 years ago, that they approached the world through words, through books, books in written prose. The young generation is very savvy, very articulate, but is slowly transitioning from the written to the visual. It is not altogether abandoning the written, but is embracing the visual as a form of thinking, as a way to project ideas. And I wanted to be in touch with that generation, a generation I am constantly in dialogue with in the classroom, to bring it out of the classroom and to play with the opportunity of using images in order to think, not only to entertain, but to think. And my impression is that a lot of the history that we receive today comes through movies, comes through television, comes through the internet, but often it comes in a passive way. And my hope is that through this subversive, this kind of challenging, contrarian images, we can also inspire some broader thought, make our readers, particularly the young, think.
Well, let me ask you a little bit more about that because, you know, as you said a little earlier, you question frequently in the book, who has told these histories before, right? Because the history very much depends on the mouths through which it's delivered. But isn't that same problem evident in telling a story largely through graphics, through a visual medium? Because as I was looking through here, I thought there are certain constraints that that a visual representation of very complicated stories presents. Like, for example, I loved the cheekiness and snarkiness in a lot of the panels. And we'll talk about a couple of them in just a moment. But at the same time, you know, you have to visually represent entire peoples. You know, there's many Native American nations, for example, that appear in panels that are visually represented in a certain way that some people might say is yet again the propagation of a certain stereotype.
No doubt. And the answer to that is that no matter how we approach the past, we are constrained by the instruments that we use to bring it back to us. Those instruments will not, in and of themselves, enable the past to come to life. They will only offer an interpretation of it. All history is an interpretation. All history is fictional. It brings forth the imagination of the historian, the imagination of the chronicler of the past, and it's filtered through that one. The limits of that imagination are also the ones that are going to be reflected on the page. However, what I tried to do here is to be critically creative or creatively critical. There are two characters that show up throughout the book. One is the author, a kind of cartoonish profile of myself, and the other one is a cartoon of Lalo, of the illustrator, and they are constantly posing kind of critical comments.
And right, they're a counterpoint to each other almost.
Constantly. And making fun of how the history in general is being told and what kind of agendas they themselves have. The point being made that no matter who we are, we have an agenda. It is crucial, though, to understand that that agenda needs to be seen in the broader context and that other people need to be brought in to understand it more fully, more objectively. There is really not an impartial way of delivering the past. Every generation brings another vision of that past with an agenda, even though that generation will say, I don't have an agenda. We don't have an agenda. It is impartial. There is no way to deliver we can't really bring all the past together. We have to select, we have to edit, we have to paste, to connect. And at the same time, we can say, well, we're pasting with connecting. We're bringing all this back together. History should not be wasted on the vision that is monolithic. History is fluid, is in a constant change, and that change is what makes it so attractive.
Listeners, we're speaking with Ilan Stavins. He's professor of Latin American and Latino culture at Amherst College and author of the new book, A Most Imperfect Union, A Contrarian History. of the United States. It's a graphic novel, a comic. Is it fair to call it a comic? I don't know what the right term is in this day.
I think it's a comic.
Okay,
yes.
it's a comic, and it's rich and it's wonderfully illustrated. And Ilan Stavins brings up a lot of very provocative ideas about the nature of what we even consider to be U.S. history. Because as you were just describing, history is a somewhat in its best form is a countervailing force against the myths, or I guess analytical history against the myths that we like to create about ourselves as a nation. And even there was one that you sort of tackle early on in the book when talking about the Mayflower and the arrival of pilgrims and Puritans to what would be later called New England, that they, you know, you say that they wanted to start over to create a free nation, yet the place where they chose to establish that nation already had its own culture, obviously because there were well-settled peoples here, indigenous peoples, which the settlers conveniently ignored. That's the only way to start anew, after all, by negating the past.
And that is, Magna, I think, a leitmotif in American history, negating in order to reinvent, destroying in order to rebuild. We love, as a society, to flatten out previous interpretations, to destroy entire cities only to bring them back to life, to say this theory doesn't work. I'm going to prove that the next one is really valuable. This idea of creative destruction that I use throughout the book, I think is one of the major forces of this country. We're incredibly forward-looking, but also astonishingly negative when it comes to the past. We have to destroy in order to build again, and
I couldn't quite figure out in this book whether or not you approve or disapprove of that.
I love the fact that you couldn't.
So, I mean, do you have an answer to that?
I think we're all part of that. One enters this river that is a nation and becomes part of it. And at the same time, one has the responsibility. For me, being an American means to be a contrarian, to have the freedom to dissent, to have the freedom to question. The questioning itself is what matters, not the alternative that is offered necessarily, but the fact that what is given to us should not be taken at face value. We should take the responsibility to wonder, as we wonder, if what we have received from the past is something we want and we want to take to the future, to the next generation. Mm-hmm. I, with my students and with my readers, it is not important to me to make them know exactly what I think. It is important for me to make them think.
Well, on this show, it is important for me to try and find out what it is that you think.
You'll keep on trying.
I'll keep trying. So let me be a contrarian to your contrarianism.
Sure.
Because one thing that I did see over reading, you know, the entire book today was that while you definitely clearly want to tell the stories and histories of marginalized and forgotten people and peoples in the United States, the book still is really white, for lack of a better term. I mean, all the founding fathers get a name check, at least. There are some prominent African Americans and Latinos. They get mentioned and their stories get mentioned by name. But I'm still thinking of, for example, in the chapter about slavery titled Slaves Are Us. I mean, it's a very white chapter, to be frank, in my opinion. And President Lincoln gets a lot of nods. You even basically reprint the entire text of the Gettysburg Address. But I don't see that many mention of individual Black Americans from that period in that chapter who were hugely influential. So there's contrarianism of a lot of different sorts. And I'm just wondering,
sure,
you know, were you trying to be contrary to the received history that most people get in school? Or another form of a contrarianism could have been to really put front and center the untold stories.
I think that would have been ideology, not a contrarianism. Contrarianism is, in my view, not to say everything is white, let's make it dark, or everything is dark, let's make it white, but everything is white, let's wonder why it's white. And the same thing with dark. The question is not so much how to populate the pages with different colors, but how to ponder the question, what is exactly what this Declaration of Independence is about, the Gettysburg Address? What are the words that are being hidden behind the text that we read and recite and ponder as if it was a legend from Mount Sinai? The questioning is the crucial part. And I should say there is no contrarian history that can live up to its mission, for the moment it is accepted, it ceases to be contrarian. So the questioning for me is the crucial part. Not a, let us embrace a totally alternative view of things. Let us wonder what the alternative might have been at different moments in history. Mm. And the goal ultimately is to make the reader not fully happy. I don't think that a book should make a reader happy. I think a book should make a reader uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, later on, as we sort of march through U.S. history in the book, A Most Imperfect Union, to my eye, the tone actually does become much more cuttingly contrarian, much more snarky. And I couldn't tell if that's because we had entered a period of history that I was personally familiar with, having had lived through it, or if you were a little more more reverent early on, because I'm thinking of a particular panel that discusses the 2000 election between Al Gore and the man who became President Bush, and you see the two of them, and Al Gore's wearing a beanie, and George Bush is wearing a cowboy hat, and Al Gore is saying in the speech bubble, "How is this guy beating me?" And George W. Bush is saying, "Is our children learning?"
I think you're right. I think that, looking back at 300-400 years of history, there are episodes that inevitably touch the historian's heart in a more powerful way or mean something more. And of course, one has the responsibility to deliver a larger picture, an epic arch of who we are and how we became. But there are contemporaries with whom we have something to say, and that might be a recent presidential figure, or a figure like Steve Jobs, or the president that we have in the United States that for many of us has been a failure. To what extent the people that we have known, or at least the people that have been of our contemporaries, are better understood than the ones in the past whom we have to dig up, undust, and bring forth. We didn't have the accessibility to their environment that we do to the present. But so I absolutely agree with you. I think there are rhythms to the book, mm-hmm. and there are rhythms that the readers will find in the book that I myself and Lalo were not necessarily attuned or conscious of. In many ways, Magna, I think that a book is written by this contract that we establish with the reader. And it's a contract not only of two attentiveness of these two individuals, but it's a contract also of the unconscious that each of them bring to it. Right. I think there are parts of the book that were done in ways that I was more conscious of, awake, and there are parts that I did or Lalo did that were the result of less familiarity with a certain object. I don't, in any way, by the way, this is a cartoon history of the United States, and I am not a historian by trade, thank God. And this is an opportunity to wonder what history is and who it should be done by.
Right. Well, you say you're not a historian, but you do offer us some pretty powerful thoughts on what history is and why it's important, especially in a country like the United States. Because near the end of the book, you say, the history of the U.S. is one of constant cutting and pasting, a most imperfect union, but it's one that's always striving for perfection. And I might offer that other people have said the same thing throughout history, recently, notably President Barack Obama, who back in 2008 said, "This union may never be perfect, but generation after generation has shown that it can always be perfected."
Yeah, we're obsessed with the word perfection, and we're obsessed with the dream about perfection. Think about the U.S. team in the World Cup and the chant, "I believe that we can win," as if the belief itself could bring the team to win in spite of our imperfections. It is the dream behind the team that makes the team for us. And in other countries, it is the technique, it is the experience, it is the history, what the German team has done or what the Argentinian team has done. So I think that this obsession with perfection makes us Americans, and it will make us for a long time. What is really to be perfect, and how do we perfect ourselves? That's what the book is all about.
Well, the book is A Most Imperfect Union, A Contrarian History of the United States. It's by Ilan Stavins, who's professor of Latin American and Latino culture at Amherst College, and illustrated by Lalo Alcaraz. Professor Stavins, it's always such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
It was a delight. Thank you so much, and enjoy, or not, the 4th.
Happy Independence War of Revolution, whatever you want to call it, Dave.
To you too.
Well, bye-bye. Listeners, stick with us, though, because when we come back, we'll talk with one of the people who warned us about the dangerous consequences of a very serious recent war, the Iraq War. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.